This podcast takes you into the rarely discussed realm of the personal decisions leaders have taken that have influenced their business decisions and developed them into the leaders they are today. The refreshingly honest experiences of those who have been very successful provide an insight into the challenges they faced, the successes they achieved, and the people who influenced them along their journey. Here's our host, Mark Silvera.
Welcome to Business Made Personal. This podcast is brought to you by the insurance industry's leading education and events provider, ANZIF, via their Careers in Insurance initiative. I'm Mark Silvera. So Tim Grafton is the Executive General Manager, Intermediated Claims at IAG, and has over 23 years of insurance experience working across numerous claims, assessing and supply chain roles. He was involved in a life-changing car accident, which left him confined to a wheelchair. And as a result, he's actually lived experience on the other side of IAG's claims experience as a customer. Apart from helping people recover from loss, his career has been defined by transforming claims teams to be more empathic and efficient. Very topical to have you on the show, Tim Grafton.
Morning, Mark. Thank you. Yeah, great to be here.
Let's start at the beginning. I always ask people about their life growing up. And in your case, let's talk about that prior to the accident. What was that like for you?
Atypical Australian, I suppose, upbringing. I grew up in the outer western suburbs of Sydney. In fact, I still live out in the Penrith area. Very blue-collar background. Dad is now retired, but he was a firefighter and usually had some other labour-related job in between his firefighting shifts. Mum's a semi-retired nurse, and so big family, Lancome home, you know, push bikes, skateboards, sports, that type of thing.
And looking back in those days, what do you remember most about growing up?
For me, the things that stick out and I probably carry into my career is probably just sort of those blue-collar values that we were raised with. Because Mum and Dad were shift workers, I have three sisters, and so we're often left to sort of independently look after each other. And so I have a really good relationship with my sisters. We get on very well. Hardworking was instilled. And Dad's favourite saying was always, if you can't be the smartest person in the room, make sure you're the hardest working one. And that sort of stuck. But yeah, just things like honesty and authenticity, family values is probably what I reflect on the most.
So talk me through that a little bit, because, you know, if my experience has been where the parents are shift workers, there's often that need to fend for yourself because your parents may not necessarily be there at, you know, let's call it the traditional times.
Yeah, so I mean, it was everything from getting yourself ready for school and there on time through to sorting dinner out. Now, my younger sister and I were fortunate enough that our older sisters were a few years older, 5 and 7 years old respectively, and so they were sort of pseudo-parents at times and thankfully didn't begrudge the role, I suppose, but it also meant, you know, sort of after school, you had a bit of freedom too, to just get out onto the streets, so to speak, and, you know, play sports and, you know, as I said, push bikes and skateboards with friends. You know, while there was that independence part, it wasn't a burden at all. It was actually, it allowed you to grow, I suppose, and just have fun and just sort of learn about life quite a bit. I reflect on it fondly more than anything else.
Yeah, it's interesting because we migrated to Australia and my parents, they worked really hard. And I, you know, at that stage, I was 11 and I was taking my brother and sister to school. And yet, it certainly did give you a lot of independence. But I don't know how you felt, but my parents were never there at sports days. They were never there at, you know, at those sorts of events. We never owned a motor car. And I look back now and I think that was probably a blessing in hindsight. But at the time, gee, I hated it.
Yeah, absolutely the same. Yeah, I'd agree. And look, it's probably, as you say, when you sort of look back on it now with a bit of perspective, not as big a deal. But then at the same time, a bit of balance to that, although we didn't have a lot, when you look back, it didn't feel like that at the time either. Like, I mean, at 10, 11, 12 years old, all I was interested in was probably more the social sport sort of elements of stuff. And I had the freedom to do that. Even if Mum and Dad weren't there, I was still able to get there in some way or somehow. And also, it sort of meant I had to solve the problem. You know, if I wanted to play rugby league and get to training every day of the week, well, I needed to organise a lift or ride my push bike there. And so probably developed quite a few skills looking back now that you otherwise wouldn't have got.
I hear you. I couldn't agree more. Hey, I want to talk about people in your life at that stage. Was there someone specifically that was a major influence on you, Tim?
My older sisters, definitely. And I probably, you know, from a family setting, come from a very matriarchal sort of family, lots of strong women influences. But my sisters in particular, because of some of the reasons I've already touched on, but also as I got a bit older, you know, and they had boyfriends, they would often include us in their outings, you know, some of their boyfriends and later husbands, you know, take me to Bathurst races or rugby league games. So certainly they had a big influence. My parents definitely did, as much as I just spoke about shift work and things like that. Still very involved where they could be and, you know, where they were able to spend time, they certainly did. And probably an uncle of mine who also involved me in lots of stuff. I'm a passionate Manly Sea Eagles supporter, although I grew up in the outer western suburbs of Sydney, and that's probably from him taking me to so many of the footy games. So family mainly are the people that probably looked up to and, you know, tried to emulate as much as I could growing up.
You'd be a popular man barracking for the Manly Sea Eagles in Penrith, I would have thought, mate.
Yeah, no, they love it. All my friends are Penrith supporters. So, yeah, look, it's always a conversation starter one way or another, Mike.
I want to move forward to how you got from that sort of life into the insurance side of things, Tim.
Maybe if I just talk a little bit about end of school, firstly. I was reasonably good at school, but I never really applied myself to the routine and the structure of it, or B, the homework side of it. I sort of had intentions to go through to year 12, but by sort of the end of first term of year 11, I realized my lack of structure wasn't going to get me there. So I actually took on an apprenticeship as an electrician, which I really enjoyed. It was a small family business, industrial electrical. But in the January of 1998, I had a really significant car accident that I was the driver of, and it was significant enough that it was probably quite a miracle that I'd even survived it and got through it. But as a result of that, along with a number of other injuries, both my legs were amputated above the knee. And so it left me confined to a wheelchair permanently. After that, you know, as you'd appreciate, I was 17 at the time. And so it was sort of life-changing physically, mentally, socially. There's a fair bit of sort of adjustment. I certainly very early on didn't want to be defined by the wheelchair. And so as quickly as I could, I wanted to get back into whatever the new normal was going to look like. And so I started trying to find whatever that new niche was. And I tried a few different things, mainly again through family and friends giving me opportunities. And it just so happened that a friend said, hey, there's a job going at NRMA Insurance. They're trialing this new thing where you can lodge claims over the phone. Maybe you might want to give it a go. And fortunately enough, I'm not sure why, but Julie Lawler was a name. Julie Lawler gave me an opportunity. I had no right to be in a corporate setting. I had no right to be talking to customers about insurance, but for whatever reason, she gave me a chance. And so by that time, I'd gone back to university part-time and I was working night shift lodging claims. So I sort of just fell into it, but I was so appreciative of the opportunity. It was a new direction, one that I wasn't really sure was where it was going to come from.
Do you mind if we go back to that accident? Because that would have been a pivotal moment for you. I didn't realise you were driving the vehicle. I just knew that you were in an accident. So when it actually happened, and, you know, there is a point where you don't really know what's going to transpire in terms of your life, but when it got down to it and they said, look, Tim, this is what's going to happen, what were the sort of things that went through your mind as a 17-year-old?
Yeah. So again, a bit of context. So what had happened was I'd flipped into a pole at a very high speed. And so the car was on its side. I spent about 5.5 hours in the car, trapped, and my right leg had to be removed to get me out of the car. So lost a bit of blood at that, quite a bit of blood at that time. In fact, I'd lost about 9 times the volume of what's in your body by then. And so as a result, you know, there was not much pain relief could do. So it was a pretty traumatic experience. You know, I felt every second of that operation. The only way to describe it is probably being 17, probably a little bit arrogant. At the time, overconfident in my own abilities, if you like. I mean, it was probably a godsend in some ways because I was a little bit maybe oblivious or naive to the enormity of it for that 5.5 hours. I knew I was in trouble, you know, and I knew it wasn't good, but I hadn't probably quite appreciated during that whole time, up until the time the doctor said, here's what we're going to have to do, what was sort of happening. It wasn't until, you know, probably 2 weeks later after I'd been in a coma. Lots of other surgeries. I mean, I'd broken my neck. Thankfully, it didn't sever my spinal cord. I had a lung collapsed. My internals were severely ruptured and I had to have a laparotomy. My left arm was completely smashed. I've got pins and plates all through it. So while the amputation is the most obvious one physically, actually, some of the other injuries were far more life-threatening and probably needed far more adjustment physically. So I know it's probably a long-winded answer to your question, but it's hard to describe what was going through my head at the time, but it's probably the fact that I was so young and arrogant, but also I think your body just, through the trauma, just kicks into survival mode. And so it's almost like your mind only just focuses on the fewest things possible. And it never really became a dramatic sort of, you know, doom and gloom sort of mindset for me ever, actually. And I can't explain why, but it never did.
I mean, part of that arrogance really does give you a little bit of protection, doesn't it, when those sorts of things occur. I guess what I'm interested in is, was there a point during the course of your recovery, and I would imagine it would have taken months, if not years, was there a point during that you've just gone, you know what, this is way too difficult and, you know, I'm really struggling here?
Yeah, there was lots of different times, and probably, you know, whatever arrogance there was there prior to the accident quickly became a recognition of a need for humbleness and a different sort of mindset. I think there were those times, but they didn't last long is probably the answer. And going back to the family sort of values, you know, I was surrounded by family and friends throughout that sort of entire time. The hardest part was probably the mental part. You know, you sort of, particularly at 17, that, you know, for me anyway, the last thing I wanted to be was different. I just wanted to fit in probably more than anything. So coming to terms with that, I couldn't control that anymore. People's perception of me immediately changed. Socially was really tough. Again, a new adjustment. And so I think what happened over the period of probably 12 months was I spent a lot of time in my own head, but what I got really clear on was just focus on the things I can control. Lots of other noise around it all, but things I could control was my mindset and a determination to figure out whatever the new normal was, even if it wasn't obvious to me sort of at the time. So there were those times, but they didn't last long, Mark, thankfully.
I think it goes exactly to what you were saying before, mate, your resilience and your family backing. Did you find that once you were starting to get back on your feet that people were treating you differently?
Yeah, I mean, they still do. You know, simple things like, you know, sort of you'll be going along a public setting, someone doesn't notice you and all of a sudden you're in front of them and they almost apologize to you sometimes. And, you know, again, I sort of go back to just what I can control. And so I don't really spend a lot of time sort of thinking about that. But certainly that was a big adjustment in the 12 to 18 months. And as I said before, that probably drove as well this clarity for me around arrogance to sort of a humbleness and just sort of reassessing my sort of, I don't know if value is the right word, but my contribution, if you like, to life and what I was, you know, going to try and set out to do it. But as I said earlier on, I remember distinctly making a decision that I was, even if others chose to, I was never going to let the wheelchair define who I was or how I lived my life. It was clearly going to mean I had to adjust things, but it wouldn't be the definition of me.
And to exactly that point of treating you differently, I don't want this podcast to be about what happened to you in the accident. I want to actually a little bit more about your life in terms of how you've managed to do what you've done in within IAG. But I do have one final question on this topic, and that is, how did you go dealing with the frustration of knowing what you were able to do prior to the accident and then not being able to do it post the accident? You know, the simple things in life.
Yeah, and sort of that, you know, that transition from arrogance to humbleness was probably a frustrating one at times, because, you know, one of the attributes of arrogance is you don't need help from anyone because you got it sorted. So I had no choice but to ask for help. Again, you know, I had family around me. My mum, as I mentioned, was a nurse. My sister was a nurse by then too. And so I had people around me as well that had a pretty good understanding of recovery and services available and the like. But I had to learn to ask for help. There were things though that I would not ask for help on. So, you know, pushing a wheelchair up a large hill, as much as someone said, let me give you a hand, I just refused to let them do that. In my mind, it was almost like grabbing an able-bodied person, throwing them over the shoulder and saying, let me get you up the hill. So, but a glass at the top of a cupboard, I mean, I had no choice to ask for help. So again, it was probably just conscious decision-making, but there was definitely frustration. And again, there still is. Things frustrate me from time to time. The simplest tasks just take longer and you have to be patient, I suppose.
Absolutely right. So you moved on from that, and I guess you've probably transformed yourself a little bit since those days. You've now got a family and, you know, you've got a full life in terms of what you're doing in terms of your personal life. Just thinking about your career, you've been with IAG, I think you said, 24 years, just a couple of a little time ago. What do you think's kept you at one organization for that period of time, Tim?
There's probably a couple of things, because I thought you might ask that. Although at the time I was probably, my mindset was one of apathy towards insurance. The car that I was driving was my sister's car. And just through virtue of the fact that my parents were with NRMA Insurance, my sister had also insured with NRMA Insurance. She had a CTP green slip. For those that are familiar with the CTP scheme back in the 90s, it was a fault-based scheme. And so because I was the driver at fault, I actually wasn't entitled to compensation. NRMA was the only insurer at that time that had an at-fault driver extension. It was modest, but nonetheless, it meant I received $50,000 payment pretty quickly. And it might be hard to believe in today's terms, but in the 90s, that actually was a deposit on a home in the outer western suburbs of Sydney. It actually bought me a house, or got me a fair way through a house. So I certainly, at that point, the brand for me and the family took on a bit of a new definition. You know, there was a real gratefulness to that organization. And then, of course, when I got the role, it was in quick succession the second time that this same brand had, I'm not sure if you're aware, but IAG is a very purpose-driven organization nowadays. And the purpose that we espouse is to make your world a safer place. And although at that time it wasn't, sort of look back and reflect on it, they were two examples for me that had made my life and my world much safer. So I think out of that, there's certainly a very entrenched loyalty to the organization and the brand. The second thing I would say is the people that I've worked with over that time, I would say I've got many, many friends, lifelong friends. But the culture here is one of giving people opportunity, empowering people, allowing people to take on new opportunities and grow, you know, and invest in yourself. And I've benefited from that, not just professionally, but also personally. And probably the third reason is, in the 24 years, although it's all been in claims and assessing of one guise or another, I've probably had 25 different roles over that time. In fact, I've rarely had a role that's lasted more than 2 years. And I love that. I have a real curiosity. I like to learn new things. The personal growth value a lot. And so the opportunity to move around and do lots of different roles has probably felt like it hasn't really been 24 years, because it's always been changing and different and something to learn.
And the other thing is, not so much on the IAG front, but in 2006, I think the New South Wales Fire Brigade launched the Rescue Ed program, and you featured in a video called Tim's Story.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, that was through my dad. Yeah. Yeah, well, I mentioned earlier, I did a bit of work with a company called YouthSafe, and they had a link in with the Department of Education, who used to go around to schools and do talks. And so through that, the Fire Brigade had heard I was doing that. There's another bit of a backstory. The Fire Brigade Union actually paid for my very first wheelchair, and so they'd already had a bit of a relationship with me, so to speak. And so, yeah, out of that, I just got invited to come in. They were launching, the Fire Brigade and the Education Department were launching an education program around risk awareness, risk safety, youth risk. And so I jumped at the opportunity. And so I've often over the years had people come up to me and say, hey, my child came home the other day and told me about this video they watched, and swear the person they described was you. Is that you? I think it's still running.
That's fantastic. So the idea behind that is to create greater awareness. Is that what that video was about, Tim?
Yeah, and to sort of give youth a bit of a different insight into the type of risks or risky behaviour, and maybe a bit of education around decision making. And I think the case study on me was one of, I was that atypical person, just got their driver's license, never thought something like this could happen to me, but actually it only takes a split second for something to go wrong and the consequences to be catastrophic. So I think my story was sort of used as a bit of a case study for a few reasons. It sort of helped with that message. It sort of helped a little bit with the Fire Brigade and the role they play and the impact it has on them going to those types of accidents. And so, yeah, I think probably the case study part, along with the message I was trying to just sort of, you know, it all aligned at the time.
I've got a friend who is in the ambulance service who had been to so many accidents that he actually had a mental breakdown as a result of seeing some of those things. And his issue wasn't the fact that he was witnessing these. His issue was that so many of them were avoidable.
You know what? As I've got older and I've now got a daughter who's driving, I've probably got a far better appreciation of the impact that it had, what happened to me has had on other people. My family, clearly, you know, I can't imagine getting a phone call at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, about your child. But I also caught up with the doctor that was part of the Westpac helicopter life who removed my leg on the side of the road. Dr. Michael Wu was his name. And similar to your friend, he left the West because of that incident, which has weighed heavy, you know, many years. But as he said to me, same thing. it just after a while, it gets way too much to look at these and just think, could have been avoided, you know, and there's nothing I can do about it, but I'm sort of left to pick up the pieces. It's the impact's pretty huge. And I've got photos of that accident that I got after. The amount of emergency services people around that car. I had a chaplain, I had an ambulance chaplain sit outside the car for 5 hours and just talk to me to keep me awake. So, yeah, probably off topic on the point you're making, but the impact it has is huge on the community.
Not at all. And in fact, I think, you know, in a lot of cases, it may not necessarily have been just your accident, but it's probably the straw that broke the camel's back.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I wanted to ask you about your job. So you've been in claims for a long period of time. And one of the things that I said at the opening was that apart from helping people recover from loss, your career has been defined by transforming claims teams to be more empathic and efficient. Do you think we're losing that a little bit with now the tick and flick mentality to claims where the claim comes in, you've got to tick, 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 then flick it off your desk and move it on?
The first thing I would say is I think in over many years, claims have sort of homogenistically been dealt with, you know, and sort of business rules and processes perhaps assume that every claim's the same or needs to be treated the same way. And so to your point around the tick and flick, I think the way I look at it is what we need to be doing better and continue to focus on is that upfront triage. Even the lodgement process, I think sometimes is just get the details that's necessary to generate a claim number. When actually, you know, particularly in the media at the moment, our focus right now is how do we actually get the right information to be able to assess what level of considered urgency or assessment or decision making is needed on the claim right now. Now, if it's a simple claim and from a customer point of view, they don't have too many questions or concerns, then the process or the business rules we apply should match that. I mean, it should be simple. It should be quick. It should be low touch. It should be less of a burden on the customer themselves or the partner versus a claim that involves your child who's injured in a motor vehicle accident and it's the first time it's ever happened and you don't know how to navigate the medical world or allied health professionals or it needs an allied health professional to help you step through it, guide you through it, take the heavy lifting away. And you don't want to wait for that. You want that. Like if you've called then, that's when you want it. So, you know, those words, I think what I've loved about claims is the ability en masse, on scale to help people and try and, you know, alleviate any concern quickly. Now, we don't always get that right and we haven't always got that right, but a bit like a hospital or a medical situation, the triage for me is the important part, that upfront triage to make sure you match the right capabilities, the right person with the right skills to the complexity of the claim that's coming in. And in, particularly in intermediated, there's a whole range. I mean, there's everything from a motor vehicle, a Holden Commodore that needs to be repaired, right through to a sole trader who's being sued, to a workers' comp employer whose employee's been injured and is significantly injured. There's a breadth of claims that you've got to sort of assess and deal with in the right way.
An absolutely brilliant point. How do we get the balance between compassion and efficiency? You know, we're talking about AI now handling certain claims and we're talking about speed of response time. You know, we see that the complaints have been escalated with AFCA in terms of delays, in terms of supplier commitments, et cetera, et cetera. How do we get that balanced, Tim?
It's a really big challenge for the whole industry. If I just sort of think about the last 2-3 years and lay out what's happened with Australia, not the insurance industry, has gone through significant bushfires, particularly on the East Coast, followed pretty quickly by a series of floods that felt like it just rained for about 14 months straight. We had COVID in the middle of that, which had all of those things, the events and COVID had a significant disruption to supply chains, both labour and materials. And now we're going through a significant period of inflation and cost sort of increasing. And specifically to the insurance industry, there's also been some sweeping regulatory change, certainly well-intended and on the back of clearly some issues that needed to be sorted out, but been a real struggle for us to make sure we've adapted and adopted in the right way. Now, if I lay all of that out, I think what's happened is we've just layered process and business rule upon as each of those issues and things we've tried to work through have happened, we've sort of transactionally just made changes, added, layered, changed, but never really sort of stepped back and thought properly around, okay, well, we're adding stuff, but have we taken anything out here or have we sort of looked at it holistically? I mean, I suppose pleasingly, we're starting to see some really good results on the back of that work. We've got a segment of claims we've called rapid. It's about 25 to 30% of the claims we lodge, we think fit that category. And they're the type of claims that are really, really ideal for a digital application or where AI might be able to play a role. But equally, we match people that get a lot of joy out of doing the heavy lifting, moving fast, agile decision-making, closing claims quickly. Now, they leave the day thinking, I close 5, 6, 7 claims a day. I feel good about that. And we've been able to take that cohort at an average cycle time before we started of about 66 days down to now we're averaging about 9 days to close those claims. And so with that builds and breeds a bit of confidence amongst people too. You know, they start to see the value of the work they're doing and it sort of comes a little bit contagious. So again, I know I've been a bit long-winded in the answer, but I think the short version of that is the way I think you do it is at times you've got to step back and ask yourself, am I too caught up in the transactional bits? And do I need to just have a look at the whole value chain, the whole process that a customer needs to go through to ultimately get to an outcome that's inevitably going to happen anyway? You know, how do we just remove the non-value-adding bits and allow people to add value in the process?
And I think it's further complicated by the fact that as an insurance industry, claims has never been the sexy part of what we do.
No one wants to claim. No one wants to buy insurance and no one wants to use it, really. It's the ultimate grudge buy, yeah.
Absolutely. So, you know, I think changing that public perception is important, but I wanted to ask you about how you found it being in claims for such a long period of time. Has there been a time where you've gone, you know what, I wouldn't mind jumping the fence here and going into underwriting or going into broking or doing something a little different? Because it can be quite taxing, right?
It definitely is. And the thing is despite your best efforts to do it right, you know, the way I describe it is what we're always trying to do is the gap between your best performance and your worst performance, how do you make that narrower and narrower so you're consistent every time? But inevitably what happens is you focus on the ones that didn't go well, and that's what everyone remembers. And it is taxing. It's hard. Major events are taxing. And so, yes, there's been lots of times where I've thought, not so much I need to get out of claims. It's probably more for me being maybe I need to go and sort of stretch myself somewhere else and just learn a different part of the insurance world or another sector, by the way. But for whatever reason, I always found a opportunity or a reason to find another role in claims. And so in the mid-10s, by then I'd spent probably 15 years in short tail, mainly direct NRMA, and I was actually itching for something different. I didn't want to be the claims guy. I wanted to do something else. But I found myself leading the CTP claim scheme. And that was like full circle for me. That was, in fact, one of the team leaders that was in that team at the time had managed my claim back in the 90s. It was a real eye-opener for me. And I just felt like my passion for claims had sort of come back. I felt like here's an opportunity for me to really, really shape the way customers experience a CTP claim and potentially influence the scheme to be a little bit more customer sort of focused and friendly. So going back to your question, that's happened probably 3 or 4 times in my career, but I've always found another reason to stay in claims, to find an opportunity to do something different in claims. And I think it's the people, in my experience, the people that work in claims and stay long are the resilient people. They're the humble people. They're there because they do genuinely want to help. And I think I gravitate to that more than anything else, because if you're not resilient and it is taxing, you don't last long, really, in a claims environment. You usually find some other place to go.
And look, more power to you. We need more people like you who have got longevity and a great memory and have been through a whole heap of change, because I get the feeling sometimes it's like Groundhog Day. You know, we go through the same process having not learned too many lessons, because we're losing a lot of the well-established people out of the industry now. So no, more power to you, mate. I wanted to take you back to that young 17-year-old who's brash and arrogant, you know, hasn't got his license yet, but about to get his license. If you were going to give him some advice, Tim Rafton, what would it be?
I'm a bit of a fan of sort of adages and quotes. You know, there's a couple that I've sort of held on to, particularly post the accident. One is the Darwin quote of, it's not the smartest or the strongest that survive, it's the one most able to adapt to the environment. Now, I'm not sure that the 17-year-old of me would have even listened to that advice anyway, but that would probably be one. I think at 17, I was probably more interested in being the smartest or the fittest rather than a bit more agile. The other one that I've really loved, and it's more of an adage, I don't know who said it, but it goes something like, your greatest personal growth comes from the darkest of times. I don't have any regrets in my life. I don't regret the accident. I don't ever think I wish I could go back and change it, because I feel like that defining moment and the 2 years post of recovery has helped drive far better characteristics and a far better person sort of in life. So while I say I would have given that advice, at the same time, I feel like you got to sort of live life to learn and grow and sort of become better, if that makes sense.
100%. I know exactly what you mean, because I wouldn't have listened to myself either at 17. I can guarantee you. A couple of questions before I let you go, Seth. And by the way, we're speaking with Tim Rafton, who's the Executive General Manager, Intermediated Claims at IAG. Tim, every guest leaves a question for the next guest. And the question that's been left by Anita Lane from Solutions Underwriting, what would you like to change about the insurance industry over the next 5 years?
The next 5 years? I'd like to change the speed at which we're able to fulfill the loss, whatever that loss is. And I know that's very broad, but I suppose what I'm getting at is, in the world of what is very technologically sort of advanced, there's lots of investment going into technology and, you know, replacing legacy systems. But I can't help but think we're still behind the curve a little bit as an industry. And insurance has been around for a long time. Running into the rear of another vehicle is not a new phenomenon. And so I feel like still there's so much opportunity for us to just speed up that point of an incident occurs and the customer or the person, rather than a customer, the person can just get back onto or back into life. You know, 99.9% of claims get paid. So if we can just shorten the period of time it takes to make that happen, I think that would not only change the perception of insurance, but it would probably change the value that it adds to the community and people's lives.
And that's a really noble cause. And just so you know, I am going to ask you which question you would like to ask the next podcast guest I get on. But before I do, what is next for Tim Rafton?
I've never had a career plan, you know.
You're singing my language. You are the first person that I've come across that goes, I'm the same, 100% with you.
I've tried a few times and I don't know, maybe it goes back to those school days of not liking structure and routine. I'm not sure. What is next for me? Look, right now, I'm just incredibly focused on trying to embed some of those changes that I just mentioned. And we've got really good momentum, particularly in our personal lines and short tail classes, where we're really just questioning what we do and how we do it. And, you know, for me internally, the vision or the language that we're using is we want to set an entirely new standard of claim service across the intermediated market. I feel like being number one isn't good enough. Number one, if it's amongst a cohort of inconsistent performers, probably isn't something to aspire to. So I'm really keen to just make sure this team and the people that work at Intermediated Claims are given the right tools, the right culture and the right environment to just set an entirely new standard that surprises and impresses the people that access it. In terms of career, I don't know. I'm having fun doing what I'm doing at the moment. When I'm not having fun or getting a bit itchy, I'll sort of figure it out then, I think.
Very well said. And the final one for you, what question would you like to pose to the next guest that we have on?
You touched on AI a little bit, and I've got a bit of a personal passion for AI at the moment and just trying to understand what this thing is. So it's probably related to that. The question would probably be something along the lines of, what unique perspective do you think the insurance industry can have or take in terms of adapting generative AI?
I'm writing that down as we speak. Hey, Tim Rafton, thank you so much for being on Business Made Personal. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. Appreciate the invite. Great to chat. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you so much for lending us your ears. Please remember to click follow on your podcast app or subscribe at bmppodcast.com.au so we can give you a sneak peek of our next guest. Until next time, I'm Mark Silvera, and you've been listening to Business Made Personal.